The employees are your company. It doesn't matter what business you're in. That's the only appreciating asset you have, and you have to treat it like that. The original founding value proposition idea gets lost in the shuffle of making more money and selling more stuff and having more market share. What dynamic companies do is they basically say to everybody, you're here, your goal is to help the organization, not yourself. I mean, anybody who thinks they're going to buy only one HR platform is very naive. It's never going to happen.
Welcome back to Future Work, the podcast about a happier future of work and the role of technology and humans within that. I am super excited to launch this third season with no one other than the one and only Josh Burson. Josh is an industry analyst and thought leader in the HR leadership and technology space. He speaks at all the major conferences, and his thinking can be found in all of the prominent magazines. Josh also authored 3 books, most recently the bestseller, Irresistible, The 7 Secrets of the World's Most Enduring Employee-Focused Organizations. Today, we discuss the modern company, technology, AI, people, and playing the infinite game. So let's dive in. All right, Josh, thanks so much for being on. It's a true honor, and I don't say that lightly.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here and talk about all of these interconnected, crazy things going on in the world of work. And everybody knows that there's plenty to talk about.
There should be enough to talk about. And actually, I want to start with a very maybe unusual topic. So this podcast is about a happier future of work. And you actually just released a podcast and a newsletter about the World Happiness Report. What made you address this report, and what are some of the lessons in it for business leaders?
Well, I've done this 2 or 3 times before. It's a fascinating study because you can't really understand HR and recruiting and the workforce without understanding the global culture around it. And what the report pointed out, there were 2 things I highlighted, and there's a lot of things in there. One is that the United States, where I live and where, you know, a lot of the world works, is not as is really dropping pretty significantly in happiness. And the reason for that, if you look at the correlations in that report, is lack of trust, primarily a sense of corruption, which is, you know, being foisted upon us by the political system, and then a somewhat of a loss of social fabric between people in the United States. But I think that's happened all over the world. But here it's a little bit worse. And that, of course, applies to companies too. You know, we have to be trusted entities, and we have to create connections between people and operate as a community, not just a business. And then the second part of it that I think is even more interesting is the statistic that the younger people, early 30s and younger, are much less happy than older people. And, you know, when you read the report over time, that's always been true. Young people have a lot of stresses that older people have kind of lived through and gotten over, but it's gotten worse. And I just had a long talk with Linda Gratt from the London Business School about this. So there's some interesting perspectives there, Don. If you'd like to talk about it, we could talk about that too.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I love that. I think 2 things that really stood out were that one, the US is dropping, also UK, even though UK is geographically very close to the rest of the European Union with, you know, Finland and my country of the Netherlands, all top 5, top 10. And then the UK is at number 20. But yes, the US dropped significantly. And then in the youth, right, because US is now number 23, for their youngest cohort that they measure, they're in the low 60s. So that's remarkable. So yeah, I would love to hear a little bit more about that conversation and like, what can we learn from that? Because we obviously shepherd a lot of young people in our organizations.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. Well, the reasons are not completely clear, but I think there's a couple of things that are pretty clear. One is that most people in their early 30s got hit with the pandemic for almost 4 years, right in the early stages of their careers, when they were making friends and professional associations and learning about their careers and getting to know what the working world is like and thinking about getting married and having boyfriends and girlfriends. All of that got delayed. Marriages are down. People are not having children at all, to say maybe postponing. We don't know yet. And I think the pandemic had a lot to do with it. I think social media had a lot to do with it. The people who wrote the report talked a lot about that. But then there's this other factor that in my late 60s, so for me, you know, a lifetime is roughly 80 to 85 years, hopefully longer. But for people in their 30s, and I know that sounds odd, but you know, you have to kind of just come to grips with reality.
Yeah.
For people in their 30s, they're going to live into their hundreds or 110 or maybe longer. So they actually have more time and there's more options. You know, when I was 30, my generation basically felt if you weren't well established in your career by the age of 30, you were way behind.
Yes.
And so there was this rat race, but it wasn't a difficult rat race. It just, you just got on the rat race and you just did it. And you just didn't think about it.
You put the hours in.
Now you have all these options. You know, you can work part-time, you can be an influencer, you can take a year off, you can, you know, and that's all great, but it's also a lot of uncertainty. And I think the third thing is because people worked at home and still do, they don't have the friendships and the personal connections that they had at work. Because, you know, at least the first 10 or 15 years of my career, all my friends were people that I worked with. And we did things after work and we went out to lunch and we went out to dinner and, you know, that kind of stuff. So I think those are all factors. And, you know, let's hope it gets better. What it means for employers is that hiring younger people, which is absolutely mandatory the way the demographics are going, implies that you have to take care of them. You have to give them a good year or two of development. You have to give them opportunities to meet other people, move them around, get them connected to people, spend some time on social activities. You know, you know, I don't know if you know much about our company. We have almost 50 people now. And twice a year, and we're all remote, and twice a year we all meet face to face for a pretty good sized meeting. One of them is sort of an entertainment meeting. The other one's our conference, everybody in the company. And so we're, you know, trying the best we can to make sure people really feel like they have some good relationships with the people they work with because everybody spends so much time at work. So I think those are all factors that big companies have to deal with. And I do think we're going to go back to the office to some degree. I don't know how you guys, how you feel about it in the Netherlands, but you know, we're not going to work at home every day. So those are all things that employers have to think about. One more thing that's come up a lot is nowadays it's perfectly okay to talk about mental health or cognitive differences or childbearing issues, medical issues at work. That all used to be sacrosanct. Nobody talked about that when I was young. You know, employers are becoming much more comfortable with all sorts of additional services to provide people. You know, by the way, you know, we don't have it in the US, family leave for parents, both genders. You know, those are things that are just going to become mandatory. I think the US is way behind there. We'll probably eventually catch up. But, you know, all of those things affect employers in a big way. So, and then, you know, you can tell when you look, I look at Glassdoor ratings a lot, you can tell the companies that are doing a good job of taking care of early career employees because their Glassdoor ratings are much, much higher. And they're, you know, operating just at a more productive, you know, they're just operating in a more productive way.
Yeah, there's something to be said for doing well by your employees. It probably will make the company more successful. And I think Glassdoor was actually the data source for your book, Irresistible, right? I think you took a very data-driven approach and you looked at what does the data tell us about the best companies in the world. I think that book is a must-read for anyone who is in business or in HR right now to understand again, like, what does the data tell us about what those top companies are doing and how could we replicate some of that? What were some of the insights in that book that were surprising, maybe even to you as you were going through the data?
Well, you know, the book, I wrote the book over a period of years. And everything I wrote in there is just as relevant now as it ever was, but it's actually coming true. Some of it was forward thinking at the time. It's becoming much more real. And I'll give you an example in a minute. So the fundamental idea of the book, and I think most people, certainly HR people know this, is that the employees are your company. It doesn't matter what business you're in. If you're a trucking company or an oil company or a software company or a consulting company or a retailer or a healthcare company, your company is employees and that is the asset you have. That's the only appreciating asset you have and you have to treat it like that. Unfortunately, our financial systems treat labor as an expense. So it's easy for the CFO to say we're spending too much money on people because it's an expense. It looks like an expense on the P&L. And it causes your stock price to go down theoretically. But actually the opposite is true. When you take care of the people, they appreciate in value and in performance in the company. So the book's all about, you know, how to do that. And just a couple of the basic principles are that, you know, industrial age, we designed our companies as hierarchies, and you entered a company with a job and you waited in that job. You did the job you best you could. You got evaluated once a year. And if you did well relative to your peers, by the way, so it was competition, you might get promoted at some period of time, and you might get a raise, and you might eventually become a manager or a leader, maybe, if there was room for you in the pyramid, because the pyramid gets more narrow at the top. And if the guy above you ain't leaving, you're not taking his job, right? So there was this patience that was enforced upon people, and that was okay. We all put up with that, and that was just normal. Nowadays, because of the transparency of the job market, the dynamic nature of companies, all the layoffs and restructurings and mergers going on, the transformations of technology, the company doesn't really, is not capable of giving you that kind of a career. And the company needs you to move around more, and people want to move around more. I talked about that just a little bit earlier about young people. So we've got to change the dynamics of how you get rewarded, how you get paid, whether you have a job title and a job level or not. Most companies have been collapsing their job levels by multiple times, like 3, 4, 5 times fewer levels so that they can have more mobility. And your manager, who used to be the gatekeeper, who told essentially your boss, the book chapter is called Coach Not Boss. Your boss was your boss. Your boss used to tell you what to do and what not to do. Now your boss is kind of like just this person who's there to help you. Who, you know, maybe gives you an evaluation at the end of the year, but they may not even be the person you're working for. You might be working, you know, with other people on other projects. So we've got to sort of think about these new dynamics in companies and how we reward people and take care of them in the context of every human being is enormously important. And now you add AI to that, which isn't even in the book, and you've just doubled or tripled the performance of every person. And add to that the fact that we're not having children, so the labor market is getting more and more difficult to hire. I think the average person who's a manager or leader, supervisor, or whatever, they don't think about this stuff all day. So those are the concepts in the book that I think are really important.
Where do you think that disconnect is? That's really interesting. Like HR people think about this, but managers don't. I mean, don't we all know that it's the people that make the company?
No, that's not true. I mean, many, many people go to work, they have a boss, maybe they don't like their boss. Their boss is, you know, whatever, got other issues, or your boss is unhappy. So they don't get a good experience, and then they get promoted and they have to be the boss. How do they know how to be the boss if somebody doesn't show them or hasn't modeled it for them? You know, leading people and leading projects and teams is very, very challenging. Human beings are the most interesting, imperfect animals on the planet. Every human being's different. So, you know, once you become a manager, your profession just changed. And learning how to lead and having a role model and a coach or somebody that you emulate is great for those of us that have had it, but a lot of people don't get that. So they have to learn about the job. So now hopefully HR people learn this because they've been doing it a lot and they've observed a lot of managers and they've gone to school and they've read books and research like what we do. But, you know, I'll give you a perfect example. Boeing. Okay. Yeah. Boeing is a national icon that is likely to become a national disaster for the United States. I mean, there are only two aircraft carriers manufacturers in the world. And every day there's more information about the culture at Boeing and how they got to the point where they've had these problems. Somebody at a fairly senior level had their eye off the ball that Boeing is basically an engineering company. It's not a financial company. Engineering has to come first, but they lost their sight of that. They also lost sight of the fact that the employees at Boeing, that most of the people I've met at Boeing are multi-generational employees. Their parents worked there, their grandparents worked there. So they're really, really committed to that company. And I have to believe, and I know this because I talked to the CHRO, that there were people at Boeing pointing out problems in quality, speed, and you know, other issues that we're not, you know, being listened to. And they're trying to fix that. And this is a really sophisticated company that's been around a long time and they have these issues. So you got to keep at this.
Yeah, for sure. But where does that start? Like in a company like Boeing, like at some point, the like short-term financial, the stakeholder pressure or the shareholder pressure just takes over and that becomes the focus. Like where does that stem from?
Well, I have this chart, you know, bar chart, it's sort of a little curve. And it basically what happens in companies is in the early stages of a company, there's a mission. There's a really big problem the company wants to solve. And everybody who joins is really passionate about it. And you know, they go after it and they really, you know, they create some kind of successful offering, product, service, whatever. It grows and grows and grows and people join and they like the mission and it becomes, you know, more and more reinforcing. And then at some point in time, you know, sometimes this goes on for many years, sometimes this goes on for 5-10 years or longer, something goes off. A competitor copies you, the product or service you created becomes obsolete for some technological reason, the market changes and the problem you were trying to solve suddenly wasn't a problem. Maybe the government changed some policy or a competitor took away that problem because they were bigger than you. And the company has to sort of rethink what it's doing. And they go
QD identity crisis, basically.
Yeah, and then there's a, you know, like Apple's going through this right now. You know, what comes after the iPhone? Yeah. They don't. Yeah. Yeah. Not the car. They just wrote off $1 billion on that, you know, so there's a little, it's a minor crisis for them, but usually it's kind of a big, you know, Philips went through this, you know them. And then the leadership team that took it to that point, many of them stay, but a lot of them leave and new leaders come in that are sort of turnaround people. And now you've got the original mission and the original vision of the company that made it what it is, and this other leadership dimension of how do we fix this? And that's a very tricky period of time because sometimes what happens, you know, they fix it financially, but they lose the mission.
Yes.
And then it becomes a financial company. And especially once you go public, the shareholders couldn't care less what your mission is. They want to know how much profit, revenue, growth, et cetera.
Yeah, the incentives change,
So these are the things that get in the way. But, you know, my experience, you know, in my own research is that core mission is always, it's important through this whole process. And I think Boeing is a good example. Johnson & Johnson. I mean, if you read the stories of Novo Nordisk, it was the original mission that created the value proposition that has to be manifested through new products and services. And when you change it, it's dangerous. So I think what Boeing's going through is they did drift away from their original mission. They bought McDonnell Douglas. There's all sorts of reasons. There's all sorts of things that they did. But they're finding out that, you know, they've got to just go back to being a really, really great engineering company. And they've got the DNA to do that. You know, and the funny thing is, having talked to so many companies about this, it comes back to that a lot. That the original founding value proposition idea gets lost in the shuffle of making more money and selling more stuff and having more market share. Another really important idea that I want to just throw into this, Don, that I think is interesting is this idea. There's this book called The Infinite Game. It's about having an infinite or abundance perspective versus a limited perspective. And if your business is focused on a problem that's on enduring problem, like engineering of flight and transportation or healthcare or something, you know, there's no end to that. You can keep working on that forever and you can get better and better and better. And one product will be obsolete and a new product will be invented. And that's okay. And that's all fun.
Yeah.
But a lot of companies play the finite game. We're going to build a product that's better than somebody else's product because we think we're smarter than them.
Right.
And then all of a sudden that CRM fizzles. Yeah. Right. You know what I mean? So these are seem kind of theoretical concepts, but they really play out all the time.
No, absolutely. Yeah, that's what I was going to say earlier, working for Ogilvy, the advertising agency, like they kept, even after he passed away, like they kept very strong holding on to that original founder and like what was David Ogilvy's perspective on the market at that point in time. And a lot of those principles didn't change, even though obviously the field of advertising changed a lot, right? The idea that you should run a company in this sort of way. And one of his big things was the advertising agency should be like a teaching hospital. So that really brought in the mindset of like, you want to bring new people in and you want to learn them the trade, but you also want to learn from them, right? So they kind of like kept going back to that. So totally believe in the culture part. So if we look at Boeing on the one side, who is someone like maybe in the book or outside of it that you feel is a really good examples for companies to emulate as it comes to becoming that irresistible company?
You know, in the consumer goods companies tend to be very sophisticated at this because they have such a dynamic market. Unilever and Nestle are very, very mission-driven, but multi-product, multifaceted companies. I think in some sense, under Satya Nadella, Microsoft is somewhat that way. They're not just selling stuff. They really do have a vision of where they're trying to take individual productivity in the business, mostly business, but also in the personal world. The Cleveland Clinic, you know, is a cancer and a big healthcare company in the middle of the United States. It's very, very successful. A lot of healthcare providers are like this. You know, I don't know if I can think about any off the top of my head, but those are companies that I have learned to admire over the years. And the interesting about them is that they don't necessarily get into totally new businesses, but they adapt all the time. It isn't difficult for them to change because people are still committed to they know what the core is. And so the employees go along with whatever the change is because they believe in the core. Disney, by the way, is another example. You know, Disney is in the middle of sort of a turnaround, but we're doing a lot of work with Disney. Disney's culture is exactly the same. I mean, it's still an entertainment and creative company. I mean, their core is being creative and entertaining people. And I think most of their businesses are still core in that area. So I kind of believe in these long-term, what I call them enduring, by the way, that's the reason I call them enduring companies in the book. You don't know if NVIDIA is enduring. It's hard to tell, you know? Yeah. We don't know. It certainly is at the moment. But one of the tests is how long has the company been around and has it survived multiple economic and technology cycles? And if it has, then there's something going on inside other than just a lot of smart people.
Yeah, that's a good measure. If that resilience is there, then obviously something keeps it going, even though there are a lot of headwinds. So I want to shift from irresistible companies to dynamic organizations. So this is a topic that I've heard you talk about a lot recently. Maybe can you share a little bit about that concept? And also when people hear this and they think I should become like that, what are some of the first steps that companies can take to become more dynamic?
Yeah, thank you for asking. We do all these big studies. And, you know, over the last couple of years, there's been this enormous interest in internal mobility inside of companies. You know, filling jobs internally with internal candidates and moving people around and reskilling people and so forth. And we originally said, let's do a study of all of the aspects of that and how are people doing it and why are they doing it and what domains and so forth. And we started doing it. We did it together, this big survey. And once we started to get the research back, we realized this wasn't really just about internal hiring. This was about culture. This was about diversity, growth, development, and a sense of creativity in the company that allows it to redesign itself as needed. And what we realized when we did the research is we again came up with, you know, four levels of maturity. But the simpler way to think of it is, in the older model of business where most of us grew up, you had this idea of a transformation. And the transformation was an episodic event. So when I was at IBM in the early days and John Akers ran the company, it was a proprietary computing company that kind of owned all the different areas of the data center. And that all fell apart when open systems came along and PCs. And Lou Gerstner came in and said, no, we're not a technology company, we're a services company.
Yeah.
And that transformation went on for 30 years.
Yes.
It might have been a mistake, actually, because they lost a lot of their technology. But anyway.
Yeah.
But the idea was that you're going to do these things one at a time, and you're going to just go like, oh, your job changed, new department, new boss, new role. Let's figure it out and then live with it for a while. But actually, what you find is today, this is actually a continuous, never-ending transformation.
In much shorter cycles.
Yeah, all the time. And the information on what to change doesn't always come from the top. Sometimes it comes from the bottom. It's the customers telling you, hey, this thing we're doing isn't working anymore. They aren't buying it anymore. Yeah. They don't like it anymore. We need to do something different. So these dynamic organizations are very good at listening to their employees and their customers very, you know, regularly, constantly. and constantly adapting the products, the services, how they're organized to do that. Now, what gets in the way of all that is a lot of HR stuff. I'm the boss of Department A, and yes, I have 50 people this working budgets for me, yeah, right? And I am a third level or a 17 level, yep, whatever I am, and I'm making so much money, and I have a corner office, and I have my own parking place. And you're telling me we're going to redesign everything and I'm not going to be the boss anymore? No, 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 no. We're not doing that, right? So there's all these people that are resistant to doing that. And, you know, they stay resistant as long as possible until the company fails and then they get laid off. Mm-hmm. What dynamic companies do is they basically say to everybody, you're here, your goal is to help the organization, not yourself. You will be well taken care of in your career as a result of working here because of all the great things you're going to get to do. But your fiefdom, your hierarchy, your job, your title, you know, that's just a little tag we gave you at the moment. We need you to do what we need you to do. And one day you might have to do this. And then a couple of months later, you might need to do that. And if we think your skills are better suited in this department, we're going to recommend you go over here and work for this person. And, you know, once you get used to that, it's incredibly empowering for employees. But you have to figure out how to pay people. The leaders have to move around too. You have to have a very inclusive company because in a lot of companies, the individuals who work in this department look different from the individuals who work in that department. And we don't understand them, or they're, you know, they're a different gender, or they're a different nationality, or whatever it may be. So it has, there's an inclusive issue of it. You have to figure out how to do pay equity, because when somebody changes from a job that's maybe underpaid in the job market to a job that's overpaid in the job market, and they take their old pay with them, all of a sudden they're underpaid in the new role. So you've got to adjust that. So this dynamic organization research shows you what all these things are about. And, you know, the crux of it is really, to some degree, HR, but a lot of it is leadership. And so we happen to do another piece of research on what we call irresistible leadership. And we're just in the middle of profiling dynamic leaders right now. We'll be doing this later in the year. The CEO and the CHRO certainly, and other leaders, have to get this, and they have to believe in it, and they have to enforce it and talk about it. And I think the best example was yesterday. There was this great article in the Wall Street Journal about Bayer. I don't know if you saw it. You may have missed it. So, you know, Bayer is this giant pharmaceutical and science company, and they bought Monsanto. You know, they're kind of a big, really successful, well-known company, but they're not moving very fast. So the CEO basically decided, we're getting rid of all this hierarchy, and we're going to organize around teams and around projects, and we're going to flatten the organization. And it's, you know, companies every now and then do this. Unilever operates this way. There's a company in, there's a telco in Australia, Telstra, that did this. And this is becoming a more and more common now as an operating model to allow a company to grow and thrive much more productively. The other reason I think it's going to become more popular is AI has a tendency to cut across organizations. We can get data and information across the company much, much faster than we could before. We used to have lots of silos. You know, I don't know what those guys are doing. You know, I don't even know what, what their systems are like, right? So the dynamic organization research is about that. And very, very high multipliers of the companies at level 3 and 4 versus 1 and 2. I mean, 7 times higher business performance metrics in our research. This is the highest ratio we've ever seen of anything we've ever studied. As far as how you get there from here, you know, if you're a manager or an HR person, the real concept is that we are all individual people. We are not our jobs. We don't own our job, and our job doesn't own us. But our skills and our relationships and our experiences can be used in multiple ways. And for us as an individual, we're going to be a more successful business person or salesperson or whatever we call, or healthcare provider, whatever we call ourselves, if we take advantage of different opportunities in our lives. And I think most people know that. They don't want to be locked into one job their whole career. But once you, everybody understands that, then these operating metrics that we talk about in the report can start to take place. And a big part of this is also the tech. You know, the HR technology platforms, the traditional ACMs, weren't designed for this. So you need some new technology tools to facilitate mobility, to help people assess their skills and identify the skills of others, to manage projects and teams and so forth. But like Telstra did this with no technology at all. They just basically created an agile operating model, and it worked. ING Bank has done this. I mentioned Unilever earlier. We're talking to Bayer in a couple of weeks. I mean, I'm going to be interesting to hear exactly how they're doing it. But I think it's going to be not every company has to do this. I mean, if you're a railroad, you may not need to do it. But
or maybe you do. Maybe you do.
You know, like the government's not very good at it. Educational institutions are not very good at it. But for companies that are very close to lots of consumers are very good at this because consumer demands change so fast, they have no choice.
Change all the time. Yeah. And you have to adjust very quickly, and you cannot do that when you're very stuck in your way of working. But it sounds like it's a really big cultural change, right? As much as maybe a technology change. And then good to hear that at least some of those like big companies have been able to pull it off, because you would almost imagine that there's just too much resistance from the inside to make that kind of transformation.
And even, you know, HSBC operates this way. Standard Chartered operates. Even banks are starting to figure this out, because the banking industry is very dynamic too. And if they can't adapt to new customer needs or geographic changes, they don't keep up either. So it touches just about every industry.
Yeah. And you mentioned that technology is a really big part of that. So I know that you did a really big sort of drawing of the landscape a couple of months ago in HR technology. You identified a couple of key categories of platforms and of offerings. What do you see now as kind of like the most critical workplace technologies for companies to adopt, especially if they need to make some of those changes towards something like becoming more dynamic as an organization? And what further changes will you see? And I'm sure AI will come in there somewhere.
Yeah, well, you can't run a company without a core HR system, but it's very clear to me that the level of technology you need to operate in a dynamic way is not going to come from the core HR system. The core HR system is primarily a record-keeping system. These really dynamic issues are usually addressed by what we call a talent intelligence, or it's now kind of an AI platform that does things like identifies every employee's skills, stores vast amounts of data about the employee, including their history and where they worked and what they've worked on. Lots and lots of things that are not stored in the core HR system. It allows you to organize people into multiple teams. So like I might have a job title A, level 6, but we're also working on this project. I'm also responsible for that project. I'm also leading this group. Information isn't even in the core HR system. So there needs to be systems for that.
And those will be platforms like Eightfold and Gloat and Beamery?
Exactly. Eightfold, Gloat, Beamery, Neobrain. There's a bunch of them. And they're basically AI driven. And the AI helps because we don't know. I mean, the core, the transactional data about what you did isn't enough to really allow you to operate in this more dynamic way, because I need to know what you're capable of doing, not what you did.
Yes.
What your performance rating was.
Yeah.
So we need more information about you, and hopefully it's intelligently assessed. So these are very powerful tools. I mean, example of something that's very cool, Heidrick & Struggles is working with Eightfold on a product called the Heidrick Navigator. And it's called, we like to refer to it as leadership intelligence. So one of the big issues in a dynamic organization and in every company is, you know, who's going to lead what and who's most qualified to lead what, and what might be a project, an initiative, a function, an organization, a business. And so, you know, people have different skills in different areas. And the way we've traditionally done that is through a leadership pipeline, a succession process, a 9-box grid, which is purely very, very non-scientific, subjective. That's what I was thinking of. And then, you know, a lot of bureaucracy and a lot of politicking. Well, that's okay when you have a hierarchy and it's narrower and narrower and narrower at the top. In a dynamic organization, there's leaders everywhere. There's leaders leading all sorts of things. Yeah. And so earlier in your career, you might have to lead something that you're fairly comfortable in because you're an expert in it, but you've never led it. So where are those people? Who are the right people? So we need to kind of think about who's going to lead what and how we're going to assess them. So, you know, there's a lot of new tools being developed now that are oriented towards this new model. And, you know, even though companies hate buying systems from multiple vendors, the bigger HCM vendors, ERP vendors, just can't keep up with it. So they'll either acquire a lot of these technologies, or eventually, you know, there'll be another, you know, generation. I mean, ADP's been working on this next generation HCM platform that has a lot of these dynamic capabilities for about almost 6 or 7 years. And they're just now getting to the point where it's got 60 or 70 customers. So there's a lot of new technology that's entering HR that's going to facilitate this new way of running our companies.
So talent intelligence is one big bucket. Yeah, my immediate question was like, why aren't the HRIS or the HCM providers building this kind of technology? But probably it goes back to it's just not their DNA. It's probably just not what they were founded on to build an AI company practically.
Yeah, there's a lot of reasons. One is they didn't design it for that. So it's architecturally not even possible for them to do it. The second is they're too busy expanding what they already have. The transactional part of HR is still massive.
People need to get paid,
If you look at Oracle, SAP, and Workday, they're doing financials, they're doing supply chain, they're doing, I mean, they have way more things to do than HR, so their engineers can only do so many things at a time. So none of them have been able to really grapple with this in a significant way yet. They're all obviously working on it, but most of the innovations are coming from smaller companies.
Talking about those smaller companies, so you have a category of vendors that you call trailblazer platforms.
Oh, you keep track companies of all that stuff, don't you?
I follow. So platforms like Sana in L&D, I know you did Galileo with them, platforms like Hibob in core HR. Two questions about Trailblazer. So on the one hand, you then basically get more modern technology that basically fits the modern company better. So things like being a dynamic organization is easier when you have that modern technology. But at the same time, there's also some trade-offs, right? Because maybe those platforms don't really have the certifications and the security and maybe some of the integration advantages that the older, the legacy platforms have. So that's one challenge. And the second challenge is that, again, then you're stitching together a bunch of different platforms that is also kind of something that most companies are trying to get away from. So how can companies take advantage of those Trailblazer platforms, maybe without some of those potential downsides?
I mean, anybody who thinks they're going to buy only one HR platform is very naive. It's never going to happen, even small companies. I mean, we have like, I don't know, 5 or 6 systems here, and we're not that big. The way it works is the vendors that come up with new technologies are usually of one of three types. They're seasoned entrepreneurs that have built enterprise software before, and maybe they've worked in HR technology before. They used to work at Oracle or PeopleSoft or somewhere, and they know what they're getting into, but they know that there's something new needed, and they carefully build something that nobody has done before. And they usually last a long time, and they usually grow pretty well. I mean, sometimes they have challenges in marketing and positioning, or they get acquired. The second category are very, very innovative entrepreneurs who don't know the HR space, but they think they do. And there it's hit or miss. Honestly, it sounds really simple to build a tool for performance management or a tool for coaching or a tool for employee assessment. You know, it sounds simple, but most of the vendors who start that and haven't done it before don't realize that there's a whole bunch of other people already have done this. Yeah. And maybe they're going into a really red ocean where there's 25 or 30 other companies doing the same thing. And so, you know, they reach a certain stage of growth and then they immediately sell out because they can't. They can't do it. And then the third category are companies that have a combination of things that just turn out to be spectacular. And I think if you look at Sana, if you look at Degreed, if you look at Edcast, for example, Cornerstone, these were companies that were founded by people that were very smart, very ambitious, very hardworking, didn't know HR, but learned really fast. And they just had this unique ability. They were humble. They had enough humility to say, you know, we thought we knew what we were doing, but we're going to change it because we were a little bit off, but we're going to move really fast because this is what we need to do. They are the ones that change the industry. And usually they get bought or they become really big. And so you as a client, as a buyer, have to really kind of check these guys out and visit them at the conferences and get to know their leadership teams and talk to their other customers and see how deeply they understand your situation, your industry, your company size. And you'll find great ones. I mean, a great example of this is Gloat. When I first met Gloat, it was like 5 guys in Israel, and they were working on a matching technology for recruiting. And, you know, they were beginning to sell it, but it wasn't really that interesting because there were other matching technologies out there. You know, theirs was a little better, but it wasn't the 10 times better. So yeah. Unilever found them. And one of the guys at Unilever, who was the head of the tech strategy, said to them, I want you to build me a system that uses your matching to implement this new internally. Operating model we have, Flex, where we want people to move around and we need a platform. Yeah. And so they jumped right into it, they built it, and voila, they had a product and really successful. So, you know, you've got to pick the ones that work for you. And also, the other factor is some companies are very conservative and they don't want to buy anything until it's very, very, very well proven.
Yeah.
Other companies like working with smaller companies and they like working on their product roadmaps and talking to the product managers and giving them feedback and all that. So
they almost see it as a benefit rather than a challenge that, maybe they don't have everything that those legacy platforms have, but this is my opportunity. My opportunity is to, like, maybe the Unilever case, almost like tailor it to what I need. And therefore, I will be more competitive as a company because I now run on software that no one has, that the majority of the market doesn't have.
Exactly. And the interesting thing for HR people is if you're working for a company that's reasonably sized, you can pick a vendor. And if you pick somebody good and you work closely with them and they listen to you, you can change them and you can change the market. A lot of the things that change the dynamics of the market are vendor innovations that some brilliant person dreamed up that nobody ever, I mean, when Ashutosh Garg thought up Eightfold, I remember talking to him, you know, 7 or 8 years ago, and I could barely understand what he was talking about. And now look what happened.
Yeah, incredible. Yes. Yeah. That definitely did well. Yeah. And obviously very AI driven. And I think for a lot of people, AI was very vague and very in the background and very sort of like a foundational technology versus just in the last 2 years, that huge transformation since ChatGPT came to the scene and people sort of intuitively get better what AI can do. What do you see now as the kind of like the state of AI? Because I know you talk to a lot of companies and I'm sure you see huge gaps in the opportunity that AI provides and then how it's actually being implemented and maybe also some of the barriers that exist towards implementing AI. Where do you kind of see it stand now? And what do you see as some of the biggest shifts coming up for companies to implement AI better?
Let me talk about the vendors and I'll talk about the companies. So the vendors are going nuts because they all know that they have to understand this stuff and they have to find a way to use it. So there's essentially a frenzy going on in the HR tech vendor market to hire people that understand AI, figure out how to use it, and stay ahead. And it's really hard for them because the technology platforms are changing, the core providers are changing, and the use cases are just barely evolving. Like, I talked to a company just earlier today who's built an amazing AI system for management coaching. And it has multiple LLMs, multiple models. I won't go into the details, but it was not easy for them to build it.
Yeah.
So there's a lot of work going there. On the client side, on the customer side, I think the thing that we have to, you know, remember, and this is what I learned over Galileo, is that the AI systems are data systems, not transactional systems. So the power and the value of the AI is dependent on the value of and the trustedness of your data. So if you buy an AI system for, you know, employee experience or for recruiting or for learning or for knowledge management or whatever many of these applications are, you are in the data management business. You're going to have to make sure that data is accurate, it's protected, it's trusted, that people only see the things they're supposed to see. You've got to continuously train it. I mean, we're now at the point with Galileo where we're watching what people are doing and what they're asking for. And we can't wait 6 months to write a new piece of research. We every time we see a new, it's actually fun for us. We're getting much quicker at doing things, but we're now constantly looking at it. And so as a company, you know, whatever data you're going to put into it or whatever data it's going to get, you're going to be in the data business, the data management business of making sure that it's accurate, training it, maintaining it, working with IT. I also don't think HR people can really buy AI systems without the IT function being involved, because the IT people are getting sold by Microsoft or somebody else, you know, some grandiose thing. And so you're going to go buy the HR thing and then they're going to have the Microsoft thing and then you're going to collide and they're going to say, well, why'd you buy that? We just did a big deal over here. And then the HR
Copilot can do this.
But that doesn't do what we want.
Yeah.
You know, so we're at that stage where this is a new whole platform. And so we got to work together on it as the two functions. I don't think, though, that the IT decisions about AI are going to keep up with the innovations in all these functional areas like HR.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, we're going to be becoming very, very expert on how AI is used in HR, that the IT people will be coming with us. So I think this is a situation where all of the evaluations you do, you should be looking at things, but bring the IT people with you so they can bring their judgment and sort of data management and security advice along with you. So it's really exciting. It's the beginning of a whole new technology platform. I mean, from the bottom up. Yeah. So
yeah, super, super exciting. And I kind of have two questions left. So one is about leadership. So you're not only advising companies, you're not only writing books and doing podcasts and talking about leadership, you're also leading yourself. You have a 50-person company, as you said, fully remote. I didn't know that, but that's interesting and impressive. How has your leadership changed over the last couple of years, and what further changes do you foresee coming as the world keeps changing?
Well, I have a very, very capable partner, Bill Pelster, who helps me run the company, and a leadership team, Mark Spratt and Amy Farner and others that helped me with this. I mean, when you're I'm sort of an entrepreneur by nature at this point, and you know, you tend to do things yourself, and I'm an engineer, so I kind of get my hands dirty and things. I would say I've learned in my particular case that, you know, the top leader really has to set the direction and the culture and push people towards the things that need to be done most urgently. But you need a leadership team.
Hmm.
There is absolutely no replacement for a good leadership team. And that takes effort. Finding the right people, working together, getting to know each other, replacing the people that aren't necessarily in the right roles, moving people around. We move people around a lot in our company, but we're really an integrated group. We're not that big, so everybody knows each other very, very well.
Hmm.
When I started my first company, you know, I didn't even want to start. I never wanted to start a company. I never wanted to be the CEO of a company.
Story of every entrepreneur.
I just ended up having to do it because it just happened, and it became like an albatross after a while. But
Yeah.
So I've learned, you know, what I am good at and what I'm not good at. And I'm not the operations guy who keeps track of everything that's going on all day. That's just not my interest. But if you find people that are complementary to you, then the team is incredibly powerful.
Hmm.
And you become very resilient as a team. And, you know, for me, in the business that we're in this weird business where everybody thinks we know everything about everything. We got to work really hard to stay on top of things.
Yeah.
So, you know, a lot of my role here is to point out things that have changed that we got to pay attention to. If we fall behind or become stagnant or become too wedded to the things that we said last year, you know, we may become irrelevant too. Our sort of infinite game is that we think we can help HR organizations continuously improve themselves for year after year after year on behalf of their companies and their employees and their customers and their stakeholders by doing lots and lots of research. If we stop doing good research, if we stop paying attention, if we don't become if we do advertising and stop becoming neutral and independent, there's all sorts of things we have to be careful about. Those are the things that I have to worry about.
And then do you think that's going to change in the next couple of years? So one really big change is going to be that, you know, doing that research and staying on top may become harder and harder with, you know, how fast the market is changing. Do you think that's going to change also then how you lead the company?
No, there will always be a need for people like us, but how we produce our information is changing a lot.
Hmm.
We're basically like a publishing company. I mean, we're producing hundreds of PDFs and courses and, you know, videos and stuff. We got to use AI. We got to be really good at AI. So that's why we put all this time into Galileo. I think we're way ahead of whatever competitors we have. I'm not sure who that is. But I mean, we've really gone down that learning curve, and we're spending a lot of time making sure we really know how to take advantage of it. And our clients now who are using Galileo are saying, you know, I'm using Galileo 2 hours a day, whereas I used to read one of your research reports maybe once every 2 weeks. Right.
Yeah.
So it's a totally different experience. We're very closely tied now to our clients, which is really fun. So that's the big change that we're dealing with right now on our side.
And then how do you do that as a CEO and as a leader? Because everyone is looking at you not only as the person maybe who knows most about this industry and most about the field that you're in, but also as like, how is this company developing? So one of those big choices you make clearly is to go with Sana and to build Galileo, which is already like that's a really big decision, right? Because you're moving away from sort of like the knowledge is in our heads and it's very proprietary and people have to access it through big reports. Suddenly people can just type to Galileo and they get the answers.
I'll tell you just really quickly. I know we don't have too much time. Let me tell you what happened. So I'm an engineer. I like tinkering with things. So more than a year ago, when the LLM market hit the streets, you know, it was a year and a half ago, I immediately became concerned about what we were going to do with all of our content. And the rest of the company was cranking away doing what we do. And I have a very good friend who's a very, very savvy engineer, young guy. And I just said to him one day, you know, it was the end of 2022, I think.
Yeah.
Do you think you could put our content into an LLM? He goes, oh yeah, I'll figure it out. So he reads the documentation on OpenAI. He builds us a prototype. We called it the HR Copilot. We stuck our research in it. He built a really nice UI to it. I show it to the rest of the company and they go like, we don't need a new search engine. I said, you guys, it's not a search engine. We showed it to the clients. Their minds just exploded because what it did is it allowed people to ask questions of the research that crossed the research in a way that they wanted the information, not the way we wrote it, because we do write it almost like a book. So I immediately said, you know, it just hit me like, oh my God, this is the future for us. So I got the rest of the company on board and everybody got pretty excited about it. And then we realized we don't have an IT department. We don't have an engineering team. We have this one guy, he's a contractor who's helping us with this. In fact, he doesn't even want to work for us. He wants to work part-time. So I know a lot of vendors and I happen to know Sana and I knew Joel and I had met him and we had a big meeting and we discussed this. They immediately jumped into bed with us to help us with this. And that's how we got to where we are. And we really love working with them. And they're just a really incredibly cool company. They're not very big, but they have a big opportunity in the market. So that's how it happened.
Wow, incredible. Okay, so one very last question. One wish you have for the future of work.
I mean, I think for every employee, hourly worker, individual manager who goes to work, I really wish that you could find an opportunity or a role or a company or a boss that lets you do what you need to do as a human being. Because I do believe in something I call the unquenchable power of the human spirit. I do believe that when companies let people do what they're really good at and find an opportunity to fulfill their passions, interests, and take advantage of their God-given expertise, we all have expertise in different things that we're just born with, that we develop over time, that the organization will thrive and the individuals will thrive. And I really have a hard time. It's very hard for me to talk to somebody who hates their job, hates their boss, hates their company. I mean, it happens. I had plenty of situations like that too. That's my wish for the future, is that we can all find a way to, you know, move ourselves into the right position, or the company will help us fulfill our desires so that work can be really ultimately fulfilling. It doesn't have to be the only thing in your life, but if it's not fulfilling, I say, you know what? Don't settle for that.
Yeah.
Find something else. That is my mission.
I love that. And a great call to action for everyone who's listening. Josh, thanks so much for being on today.
Thank you, Don. I really appreciate, you know, taking the time to ask all these wonderful questions.
My pleasure. Thank you, Josh.
So that's it for my conversation with Josh Burson, the leading HR consultant. And here are a few takeaways to apply as a leader. Number one, taking care of people. Josh reminds us that our people are the company. While our financial system may see people as an expense, companies should look at people as their most valuable asset and invest heavily in them, which in turn strengthens our companies. Number two, keeping people connected. Happiness is dropping significantly, especially in the UK and the US, and especially amongst young people. Some of the causes include a lack of trust, a sense of corruption, and a loss of social connections. This last part, says Josh, is due to the pandemic, when people entered the workforce remotely, missing out on many of the opportunities to build social bonds. Companies have to create connections between people and operate as a community, not just as a business. This may be harder in remote settings, which is why it's an effort we all have to take. We have to give people great development plans, we have to give them opportunities to meet each other, and this is exactly what Joss does with all of his 50 remote team members twice a year. Number 3. Becoming an irresistible, enduring company by playing the infinite game. We often talk about employee value propositions and employer brands, but what actually makes an irresistible company? Well, Josh wrote the book on it, and it was based on Glassdoor data. And he found from that data that the best companies are enduring companies that play an infinite game. Those companies start with a very clear mission and a problem to solve, and then adapt with the market. They don't fixate on a product but on a problem, usually an enduring one, like the engineering of flight, or transportation, or healthcare. He points to companies like Unilever, Nestle, and Microsoft under Satya Nadella, which are very mission-driven companies in highly competitive markets. These companies don't necessarily get into totally new businesses, but they do adapt all the time, so it isn't difficult for them to change. It helps them engage and retain their best people because they continue to be committed to the core mission, like Boeing with multiple generations of engineers working there. Insight number 4 is about transforming to dynamic organizations. Companies, of course, always have had transformations, but now they have to happen much faster. Listen to your employees and customers, because they will tell you where the change is needed and then adapt your products and services towards that. But it also means that you have to adapt internally. You have to focus on goals instead of titles and budgets. And you have to focus on every person as the unique individual that they are, with their strengths, their skills, their relationships, and their experience, because they can all be used in multiple ways. And this will pay off, because the Burson research shows clearly that dynamic organizations like Telstra, ING, Unilever, and Bayer have seen 7 times better business performance than other businesses. And the second to last insight is about a new generation of work tech. The traditional HR systems that we all know were not designed for dynamic organizations. The organization of the future needs to know who works in them, what those people are good at, what they will be good at, what's their potential. So a new category of software that's called talent intelligence is on the rise, and this includes platforms like Eightfold and Beamery. So Josh recommends for any company to have a conversation with vendors like these and to see where the opportunities are. There may be some downsides to newer technology companies, but don't forget about the upsides, right? You could work with someone that can tailor technology to your needs and perhaps adjust their roadmap to fit your purpose, making you more competitive and potentially not just change the vendor, but the entire market. And the last insight is about AI and the future of work. So while it's clear that AI has the potential to transform companies, for example, through use cases like those skills marketplaces, Josh reminds us that AI is really about data, and that the power and value are in the trustedness and accuracy of your data. And also that you'll continuously have to train your LLM on the new data. Josh also remarks that AI is a huge opportunity for HR people to really lead the agenda. You cannot really buy AI systems without your IT team being involved, so definitely include them, but lead with the functional agenda. What do we want these systems to do? So that's it for today. I hope you enjoyed this much longer than normal episode with Josh Burson. From next week, we'll be back to our usual 30-minute executive briefings, and we will do that with our guest, Q Hamirani, the Chief People Officer at EdTech Unicorn Paper, who previously led the famous Work Anywhere program at Airbnb. Subscribe for updates at flexos.org/futurework.